echo from the ages.
No matter how far back we go, mankind's first consciousness is of being transported. He was carried by his mother before he was born, and afterward by her until he could walk. Only in animal life is there a combination of such nature for reproduction and transport.
This was a statement of a classroom instructor in an Eastern university in 1780.
This is Face to the Future, a new transcribed series on this station produced in cooperation with the North American Air Defense Command. Its conductor is Del Vina, well-known broadcaster, author, lecturer, a lady of adventure as well. It's Face to the Future. And here is our hostess, Del Vina.
Welcome again to Face to the Future. One of man's most interesting triumphs has been in connection with vehicles. The youthful bicycle rider still yells, "Look, Ma, no hands." The airborne speedster is proud of the minutes and seconds by which he and his vehicle beat the best time in existence before his own exploit. It's through vehicles and vehicle engineering that man has been able to go beyond himself, to do more things than his own native capacities can provide by themselves. As we face to the future, much depends on refinements and sophistications of vehicles. Here is General Bernard Schriever, Commander, Air Research and Development Command, commenting on this.
Space vehicles, ballistic missiles are new, they're glamorous, and they have caught the fancy of the American people. Yet on the other hand, they are very important vehicles for the national security, and as we go further down the line time-wise, they will play a more and more important part for maintaining the deterrent posture, which is so vital to our continued survival.
Will these ballistic missiles have other than military capabilities?
Yes, I think all of the ballistic missiles will be used as boosters for space work. All of these boosters will have a very valuable part to play in our continued space effort.
It's popular in some quarters to be concerned about the military emphasis in various aspects of the space project, to translate the presence of military men as meaning that only the warlike angle is being pursued. Along these lines, I turn to nuclear and mathematical physicist Dr. Charles Critchfield of Convair in San Diego. How about this high percentage of military presence in space activities, Dr. Critchfield?
Well, this is a kind of an operation that compares with military operations. It's hazardous to the individuals that are concerned, of course, assuming that men would have to go on these Buck Roger things. But we absolutely have to do it.
How big will one of these vehicles have to be to take a man on a Venus trip?
I would estimate the weight to be 1 or 2 million pounds at the takeoff. This is based on a guess that you need about 100 pounds for every pound that you want to get there and get back.
The search and research effort continues to hunt for the means of guaranteeing that man will live through the initial exploratory stages, and that his protection will be commonplace in the advanced stages. One of the experimentations in this area is with nose cones, the search for materials which will resist and ward off destructive heat in extremely high ranges. Here is Mark Morton of the General Electric Company in Philadelphia, standing beside a charred, recovered nose cone which was successfully flown, describing whether nose cones could sustain life of man in space.
Very definitely. There is, in the first place, a good deal of delicate equipment inside. The inside temperature is controlled. In addition to this, the size of the cone, its weight, being well over a ton with a payload capability well over 600 pounds, and its size being over 12 feet with a 5-foot diameter, could, with the proper equipment, have definitely supported life.
The Soviet Union is proudest of one kind of graduate in its schools, the engineer. The communist politician long ago realized that dogma might be all right, but modern developments and achievements would go a long way to reinforce it. America's engineers, who have changed the face of the world as our fathers knew it, are still hard at work on more changes. They are concerned with the numbers of engineers being produced in the schools of North America, and the quality, because in them is represented America's follow-on capability. Rather than emphasize and therefore discourage a future engineer by bearing down on curriculum difficulties, today's engineering leaders are pointing to some of the future challenges of technical ability and imagination, which temptingly lie in the upcoming decades. To illustrate this, here's my next guest from Burbank, California. Will you identify yourself, please?
This is Hal L. Hibbard, Senior Vice President for Engineering, Lockheed Aircraft Corporation.
You were one of those fortunate people who knew exactly what he wanted to do when he was still in school. You wanted to be in the airplane business. How far short did you fall in anticipating what was to come in your career, the kinds of vehicles you'd be working on?
I'm sure I didn't come even close to envisioning the state of air sciences today. As a boy, I thought in terms of flying only. And now, of course, we're concerned with space projects and all of the problems related to man's mastery of this new dimension. As for heading an engineering department someday, I'm sure I never gave that a thought. You said I was fortunate to know early in life what I wanted to be, and I was. I was fortunate to be deeply interested in the field of aviation. I was concerned with the work, not where or what it would bring me. You know, I've observed this attitude of mind in many, many engineers. Their work is the important thing to them. They are so engrossed in it that many of these men don't even know how much money they make.
If you had the opportunity to pick talent being produced in the schools, which ones would be of most use to you today in vehicle engineering?
Well, I would say physicists certainly would come first, for this science is very basic to our efforts. And chemists are becoming more and more important with our rocketry and the special fuels required for travel into space. And then mathematicians. We do need mathematicians for work in many, many fields.
There's a great deal of uncertainty and not a little impatience among students today. Do you have any practical guidance for them?
Generally on the subject of education, I want to recommend to young people today that they take all the schooling they possibly can. Our lives and work now require it. Finish high school. Then by all means finish college. Study as long as you can and get as many degrees as you can. And whatever you do, don't be impatient. This investment of time, effort, and money will be repaid you many, many times over.
Your company, Lockheed, has built us many of the planes and instruments which have been helpful in the air defense of North America up to the present time. What do you see as some of the challenges of engineers in providing future safety from an enemy using the aerospace medium?
The engineer has a very real responsibility in this regard, to work constantly to make our weapons better and better, continually improved, and always so formidable that an enemy would not dare to attack. I do not believe there is any such thing as absolute safety, just as it seems unlikely that there is any ultimate weapon. Our safety is in our strength to deter.
So in the area of vehicle engineering, science fiction of old is becoming engineering facts of today. What were once the fanciful doodles of the engineering visionaries and were once described as none such artwork, because there really was no such thing, are now being welded together in reality. As medicine tries out men in sealed capsules to determine what it does to them physiologically and psychologically, engineers make adjustments in their vehicles to accommodate them. Like everything else, there's both a military and peaceful application. Now, one more question to Hall Hibbard. What are the implications of vehicle engineering at the year 2000?
Well, it will be as different then as today is from Kitty Hawk in 1903. Imagination wasn't big enough then to encompass the meaning and potential of the Wright brothers' flight. And I'm sure it isn't strong enough today to see 40 years ahead to the year 2000. We can be sure only that there will be a comparable period of progress. Although there are certain things that are near enough at hand to be predictable. For example, the family automobile will be going out of style. We will have taken to the air. Commuters will fly at 500 or 600 miles an hour to their city-center jobs from homes in resort areas several hundred miles away. Their airborne vehicles will be very simple and safe to operate and will follow largely prearranged traffic patterns. An intercontinental flight will be by rocket, traveling a ballistic trajectory which will probably reach 200 miles above the Earth at its highest point. And man will have traveled in space by that time. He will have visited the moon easily and gone beyond. It's how far beyond that is difficult to say.
Today's 5-year-old boy, who can fold a paper plane which will sail by the propulsion of his throwing arm, has riding on his shoulders, his brain, and his imagination some of the things which are today denied our vehicle engineers. As the processors pay attention to him, parents and pedagogues alike, so may they assure that he attracts the attention of the world in that time ahead.
This has been Face to the Future, a transcribed series on this station produced in cooperation with the North American Air Defense Command and featuring Delvina with her parade of interesting guests. Be with us next time as we put our face to the future.